Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting authors on. In the first half, we're going to have Michael Keyes. He's a historian and author of the new book, Unbelievable. And in the second half, we have Judith Finlinson, and she's the author of You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. But first, we're going to listen to Alan with the Health First News.
Fungi living in the gut can move into the pancreas, triggering changes to normal cells that can result in cancer, a new study suggests. The finding could advance the prevention and treatment of pancreatic cancer, which is usually fatal because it's often detected too late. The disease has been in the news lately because Jeopardy host Alex Trebek is waging a battle against an advanced form of the illness. While the exact causes of pancreatic cancer remain unclear, the American Cancer Society has long recognized that viruses, bacteria, and parasites can help spur pancreatic tumors, the authors of a new study noted. But fungi haven't been shown to play a role until now. The report was published October 2nd in the journal Nature. British researchers have good news for people with type 2 diabetes. You don't need to lose a ton of weight to make a difference in your health. In fact, they found that losing just 10% of your body weight during the first 5 years you have the disease can lead to remission of type 2 diabetes. That weight loss would be 18 pounds for someone who weighs 180 pounds. It doesn't matter what diet helps you lose the weight, and it doesn't matter how slow or how quickly those pounds come off, the investigators found. Even small amounts of weight loss can help you achieve remission, said study author Dr. Hajira Damba Miller. Extreme dieting and exercising are not necessary. She is a general practice physician and clinical lecturer at the University of Cambridge School of Clinical Medicine in the United Kingdom. The study was published online recently in the journal Diabetic Medicine. Your energy-efficient washing machine could be harboring superbug antibiotic-resistant bacteria, a new study warns. The warning follows an investigation at a German hospital where drug-resistant Klebsiella oxytoca was repeatedly infecting newborns. Investigators traced the outbreak to a washing machine, and the infection stopped only after it was taken away. This is a highly unusual case for a hospital in that it involved a household-type washing machine, said study first author Dr. Ricarda Schmidhausen. He is a senior physician at the Institute for Hygiene and Public Health at the University of Bonn. Hospitals usually use special washing machines with high temperatures and added disinfectants. Home washing machines clean at lower temperatures that save energy, but may not kill drug-resistant germs, researchers warn. The report was recently published in the journal Applied and Environmental Microbiology. Could living near the coast be an inexpensive balm for mental troubles? Dr. Joe Garrett, a researcher from the University of Exeter in England, said our research suggests for the first time that people in poorer households living close to the coast experience fewer symptoms of mental health disorders. When it comes to mental health, she said in a university news release, this protective zone could play a useful role in helping to level the playing field between those on a high and low income. For the study, her team analyzed survey responses from nearly 26,000 people who took part in the Health Survey for England. The investigators compared people's health to their proximity to the coast and found that people living in towns and cities near the coastline reported having better mental health, even the poorest folks. The report was published September 30th in the journal Health and Place.
Michael Newton Keyes, he's the author of a new book called Unbelievable, Seven Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion. Michael holds a doctorate in the history of science from the University of Oklahoma. He has received research grants from several organizations, including the National Science Foundation and the American Council of Learned Societies. He is a senior fellow at Discovery Institute and a former Fulbright scholar. Keyes serves as a lecturer in the history and philosophy of science in Biola University and is on the board of directors at Ratio Christi, a network of apologetics clubs on college campus. So we have Michael with us today. And how are you, Michael? You there?
Doing well, Kathy. It's a beautiful sunny day here in the USA, and I'm glad to be on your show.
Lovely. So tell us a little bit about your work as a historian.
Right. Well, you can study the history of anything. Well, why not study the history of science, that area of academia that has most transformed the world? I mean, we live in a totally different world because of all this science-based technology. So obviously, if you want to be modern, if you want to be rational, you need to come to terms with science. And a lot of people think that science is against religion, but I've written a book that shows otherwise, that science and religion are actually in harmony when you correctly understand both.
Okay, so the discovery that humankind is so tiny and insignificant compared to the vastness of this big universe we have, is that a blow to Christianity?
Many people think it is. Bill Nye, the so-called science guy here in the U.S., he's famous for saying, you know, I'm just an insignificant speck of, you know, dust in a vast universe. I'm so small, I can't be significant. And he concludes, I suck, and I quote him. Well, you know, that really doesn't rationally follow. Really what he means is religion sucks, or the religious basis for human significance sucks. He thinks that just because we're small, we can't be important. But, you know, another part of that myth says, well, it's only in recent times that we discovered the universe was big. Ancient religious people and medieval religious people, in other words, before the modern world, they thought the Earth was, that the universe was really small, and therefore we were significant in such a small universe. But it turns out that ancient, even ancient Hebrew poets like the psalmist in 103, Psalm 103, thought the universe was really, really big, and compared God's love to the greatness of God's love to the greatness of the size of the cosmos. Now, whether you believe God exists or not doesn't really matter. As a cultural observation, these religious people believe the universe was huge and saw no conflict between that and belief in God.
Hmm. Okay, let's go back to Christopher Columbus. Did medieval Christians really believe that the Earth was flat?
No, they didn't. In fact, what's ironic about that particular myth, Kathy, that I debunk in my book, Unbelievable, is that after teaching U.S. college students astronomy for a quarter century, I would test them on their own basis for belief in a round Earth as opposed to a flat Earth, and most of them could only give maybe one reason, but typical medieval university students, that is, in Christian Europe, could give about a half dozen really good observation-based arguments, you know, scientific arguments for a round Earth. Most college students today accept it on faith rather than based on scientific evidence. Medieval students, supposedly religious to the point of burying their head in the sand, were supposed to not know this, but they actually know it better than modern students. So that's ironic, isn't it, Kathy?
It's very ironic. So, Michael, can you tell us some of those ideas that they had back then?
Sure. So in the medieval world, so this is between the fall of Rome, around 450 or so. I mean, Rome took a while to fall, but between the fall of Rome and the rise of a distinctly European culture, medieval Europe is at the beginning of that, you know, the beginning of Europe. And sure, Christianity had a big role to play in culture, and it was surprisingly, for many people, very science-friendly. Like St. Augustine, very famous Christian theologian, he advised people to understand the world based on reasoning and experience, and he expected, and along with a lot of other Christians, that we would be able to understand the world because God made the world and he made the human mind in his image so that we should be able to track truth, you know, with due respect for human frailty and, you know, we sometimes get incomplete answers, but it gave some reason for confidence that we can know the natural world and how it works because God made it and consistently operates it so that, you know, we can discover what we call natural laws.
Okay. Yep. Michael, when you look at in the beginning and it was only 7 days, how do you get your head wrapped around that?
Yeah. Well, I actually think the universe is the standard age, about 14 billion years old, as do a lot of Christians who know the science and realize that the Bible doesn't teach one way or another whether Earth is young or old. And there's an interesting history to this, and I really don't get into that in my book. But I do get into other issues like the motion of the Earth. I mean, does the Bible teach the Earth is at rest? Not really. It's neutral on the topic, just like it's neutral on the age of the Earth. God expected us to use our reasoning and our experience to figure out things like the age of the Earth and whether Earth is moving or at rest. And we've done a good job at doing that. That's what science is all about.
So there was nothing to tell us how that our Earth moved or that there was constellations or stars or anything like that and the distances. There was nothing like that in the Bible?
Well, there are descriptions of the Bible of the universe, and they're always observational language. In other words, they describe the world the way it appears to us with an eyeball resting on the Earth, you know, looking out. It looks like things move around us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, scientists today still use ordinary observational language. For example, a scientist and his or her spouse on the balcony, a romantic moment, they don't say, look at the beautiful Earth turn. That would just squash the romance, right?
Right.
They look at the beautiful sunset, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's technically not accurate to science, but we all know there's no error that scientists today make when they utter that phrase, because it's observational language. The Bible uses the same kind of language and is neutral on the cosmology.
So it doesn't really have anything scientific. It's more creative writing or more English writing than science, though.
Well, I mean, when it does describe nature, there's no reason to think that it's an error. It describes the way it appears to us. And, of course, its emphasis is on God and our relationship with God, not on what's happening behind the scenes in nature. So, yeah, it's not a scientific textbook, but what it does describe about nature is fine, just like scientists today use ordinary language to describe nature without error.
Mm-hmm. And with Galileo's trial, it showed that science and Christianity were at war, didn't it?
So it seems. It's often thought that he was tortured by the Catholic Church for holding to a moving earth, you know, the topic we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out they could have threatened to torture him, but he was the most famous scientist in Europe. They treated him very well. He was he had palatial place to stay when he was waiting for his trial in Rome. Now, to be sure, the Catholic Church was guilty of overreach. It was in the middle of the Counter-Reformation, so they were hypersensitive over anything that would challenge their authority, because the Protestants did. And so they did force Galileo to recant on his views. But what's really weird about that is the chief inquisitor, and I write about this in my book, Unbelievable, the chief inquisitor, a guy named Bellarmine, he said, look, Galileo, if you could prove the earth moves, we would have to understand the Bible in light of that truth. He understood the Bible could be interpreted either way. But, you know, Galileo, in his own lifetime, never proved the earth moved. That took a whole generation after Galileo for that to be proven beyond reasonable doubt. But many new atheists like Dawkins and Tyson, they just do bad history. I mean, they read like the modern view that, well, of course the earth moves, and of course we know there's good proof the earth moves. Well, of course we do. But at the time of Galileo, that proof was not available yet. And so it really was an open question. And the church was, at least in principle, open to either view. But of course, at the time, there was no good evidence the earth moved. And so they overreacted to Galileo and forced him to recant on his views.
Mm-hmm. So, and there's many Christian scientists who are very excited about everything that comes to be, everything they learn, and it doesn't change the truth of the scripture.
Right. I mean, Galileo perceived himself to be a faithful member of the Catholic Church, or, for example, Johannes Kepler, living at the same time, was a faithful follower of the Lutheran version of Christianity. For the most part, just minor doctrinal differences, but, you know, he believed in basic Christianity. And they were very enthusiastic about their science. And in fact, their Christian theology motivated their science. They believed that God made the world, God made the human mind, the two can connect, like I described earlier. And they just explicitly talked about that in their scientific writings. They were doing science as Christians, and not only did they not see conflict, but they were motivated and guided by the idea that we can discover because God made the world in an intelligible way. That is, a way that can be discovered by human minds.
Wow. We're going to have to go to a quick break, Michael. And when we come back, we'll continue to talk about science and religion, not as far apart as we thought.